From Relay, this is Downstream, a podcast about the present and future of television. This is our holiday episode. It's episode 109, recorded December the 17th, 2025. I am your master of ceremonies, Jason Snell, and I'm joined this time by somebody I like to check in with every now and then, maybe for a holiday visit. It is my old compatriot from the TV talk machine, Tim Goodman. Hi, Tim.
Ho, 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 Jason. How are you?
Good. I was just listening to your excellent holiday playlist, as I always do.
As you always do, yes. And you have your own, and you go strong on yours, too. You've been listening since after Thanksgiving, I hope?
Yeah, I actually only just started this week. This week is when I kicked it into gear. I'm late to it.
You're late.
I'm late to everything. I don't even have a tree this year. So for those who don't know, I got to get one tomorrow. Tim was a chief TV critic at the Hollywood Reporter for a long time. Before that, TV critic at the San Francisco Chronicle. And now you are the proprietor of the Bastard Machine Substack at timgoodman.substack.com. I'm going to put it right at the top. Plug the Substack.
Excellent. Yeah. That's good. So, because no one has a Substack. So
no, there are very few newsletters available. I say to myself, there should be more subscription-based newsletters that I could try.
Yeah, I think that's I think that's wise. So yeah, I'm there. I'm the proprietor. You called me. Yeah. That's kind of interesting. So that means like I'm kind of like the semi-owner. I run it.
Yeah, you run it. It's your thing. Mm-hmm. You only answer to the readers.
That is true, actually.
Which is actually pretty. It's pretty nice. I've been enjoying. I am of course a subscriber. I've been really enjoying it. I don't know. I mean, I want to check in with you about you're making your lists. So we talk about best shows of the year. I think this is a great time to do that. Mm-hmm. But before we get there, just stuff that you've written about lately that I want to talk about. I mean, I don't know.
Sure.
The news broke. So I guess since it's this podcast, I want to at least mention the news broke today that in 2029, the Oscars are going to move from ABC to YouTube.
Yeah, I saw that. And I did what I just did there. I laughed.
You laughed.
I mean, it's probably not like that bad idea. People will probably do it, but I don't know. Is that a plan to make things younger? Because I can only imagine so many people who are older and film buffs and who support the industry and are not tech savvy, not being able to do the YouTube thing.
Right. Are going to struggle with it. I don't know. Are award shows relevant at all?
No, I don't think so.
Mm-hmm. I think not having them available, I think ABC streams it for free at this point.
Okay.
So I don't know what the play is here other than to get people. I think maybe YouTube, one of the things they're hoping is that it'll get those older people to tune into YouTube and figure out how to use it, teach them how to use it. I figured Amazon's number one motivation in doing Thursday Night Football was it made a whole generation of older football fans have to understand how to get Prime Video.
Yeah.
Like and use an app on their
and then
TV. Yeah,
and then do their shopping.
Yeah, exactly. So
yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I don't know if the Oscars is relevant. Maybe putting it on YouTube and letting people, you know, comment on it and cut it up into clips and stuff like that can reconnect it with another, you know, with another audience. My daughter loves movies, really loves them. And so for somebody like her and her compatriots who love movies in that generation, you know, maybe they can find a way to interact with this concept, or maybe it's just an outmoded 20th century concept. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not against it because, I mean, I did laugh when I heard it, but because it just seems, I don't know. It just seems like the crumbling empire.
Yeah.
It's like another rock comes out. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But my son is also newly into film. And so, yeah, if he can connect, I just don't, you know what that generation, how they watch it. I mean, he's watching it on a flat screen. Mm. I've told him many times that, don't watch it on your phone. Don't think he has an iPad. So it's like movies are made to be watched on at least a bigger screen than your phone. So I don't know how many people are doing that, but if they can connect to the industry and to directors and maybe even to commenters and other sites via YouTube that break down film and talk about film criticism and just why we love cinema, that could be good for them. I don't know. I think it is that point, though, where they're you're merging generations. You're trying to, it's like the Warriors two timeline plan. Mm-hmm.
How'd that work out?
It's not very good.
Not very good. No.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, the Academy relies on the Oscars for, I saw it today, it says like 60% of their revenue is the Oscars. So they need the money. And you know, the Oscars isn't sacred really. It should grow and change with the generations. If people want to see it, they should, you know, be able to see it in whatever form that is appropriate. It doesn't need to stay the same.
But, yeah, I'm with you.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I enjoy watching it. I don't always watch it, but I enjoy watching it. I was in Hawaii, I think, last year when it was on, and we streamed a little bit of it from the beach, and I thought, this is the life.
Yeah, now that's actually pretty nice.
And then I turned it off, and I was like,
I haven't watched all the way through since I was required to do it for my work.
Mm-hmm. I know exactly. You've written a bit about movies on Bastard Machine, which I think is it's a fun little twist. It's like, oh, look, they let Tim watch movies now.
Yeah, I think that's helped. I think it's expanded, because obviously people are interested in both, and you know, they're primarily there for television, but I think I know the subscriber base pretty well, and they seem to be into movies. A lot of them are asking for more coverage, and so I'm trying to mix it in. You don't want to do like four or five posts about movies in a row, but yeah. And this year I'll have a list sometime of the films I saw. There were so many great films in 2025, you've read it, that the sort of the mantra over at what I do on Substack is that I'm not really tied to the year. It's like, if I watched it this year,
it's a year movie, then it
counts.
Yeah, I agree.
So I think that's how most people watch not only television, but certainly movies. Movies are meant, you know, they're meant to last generations. Yeah. So
if I saw a great movie this year that came out in November of last year, it goes on my list of favorite movies of this year, because I saw it this year. Right.
So I feel the same way. In fact, recently I've been writing a few things. Actually, I've been writing a lot of things about zombies, which is strange. But there was a 2019 and 2020 series on Netflix produced out of Canada called Black Summer.
Right.
It was a zombie thing. I think for the most part it got lost. But when I kind of brought that up, the people who on my Substack who had seen it loved it. And I'm watching it with my partner, KV, and I have to tell you, as somebody who loves unique zombie shows, this one is formally, like, you know, with its structure, super different than anything I've ever seen. And I'm in the middle of the second and final season, so they didn't get a third season, but it's surprisingly really good. So, you know, again, these are really old shows, and I have a couple of those on my list. There were more last year, but I have a couple on my list.
That's nice. I wanted to also mention, so when I had Alan Sepinwall on a month ago.
Yeah.
I'm slowly ticking off all of the people whose TV writing I've read over the years with you and Joe Adalian and Alan.
Joe.
Joe and I basically talk every month on this podcast. It's great. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of fun. It's a similar dynamic to you and me, which is like, I want him to have a place where he can talk about this stuff, and he's not going to do it on his own, so I can do it with him, and it's fun.
Yes. Yeah, no, I think that's great. There's plenty of times when I have missed our revived second version, which I think was that, you know, clearly the more listened to and the more professional version, as you know. But I do kind of also long back for the days in 2007 when we were doing the podcast and the Chronicle didn't even know it. You know, there was just some fun stuff about that. That felt like such early days DIY.
Yeah, that's what it was. Nobody was watching, and it was kind of guerrilla creation under the auspices of the paper, and it was people who worked at the paper, but the paper didn't know. You had an intro for a while that always makes me laugh, because the guy it's like the managing editor reading this thing, and he doesn't know what podcasting is. So he says, you're listening to a San Francisco Chronicle podcast. It's like he stumbles over the word a little, because he's like, what is that, what it is? You know, podcasting, my friend Mike Hurley says he's been working in podcasting for whatever 15 years, and it's been declared dead like four different times.
Because
it just changes, and And but we had a good time when you were at THR. The big thing about the TV Talk Machine was we were taking advantage of the fact that somebody had basically tied you down and forced you to watch TV shows. And yes, then true. you left.
Yeah.
It's like Tim doesn't have to watch TV. How much watching are you doing now, and how is your, this is one of the things I asked Seppenwall, and we know, I mean, he's legendarily, like, I don't know how he writes.
He's a workaholic.
It's amazing. But how have you balanced out now that you're kind of in the groove with Bastard Machine, the Substack, of like, because I always had this as somebody who works on my own, which is like, I'm my own boss. So I need to set up an idea of like, how much am I supposed to be working? How much am I supposed to be producing? So have you tried to figure out a way? Obviously you're not watching like you were at THR, so, or the Chronicle. So how do you kind of like pick what you're going to watch and also like make sure that you don't get back into the thing where your life is taken over by TV stuff?
That's a great question, because that's the balance that you're looking for. And, you know, I think January is going to be my fourth year anniversary, somewhere in the early part of January, which is a little bit shocking. You know, I started it when I still had a development deal to make TV shows, and or just got out of that, actually. And I can't remember now. And it has evolved through the years as the industry has sort of kind of crumbled and changed. You know, you just have to adapt with it. Like, you know, I think I'm doing a little more of it than I thought I was at the same time, but I'm nowhere near what I was doing when I was like a full-time professional TV critic. And I don't want that to be like, right. Cause that's, I'm sort of past that now, but I'm finding more joy in it. And I think the balance, you know, you were saying what, how much should I be doing? You know, all that kind of stuff where you're self-monitoring. I feel like it's easy for me now because I only do what I want to do. And right. And I can turn whatever I'm doing. You know, I always considered this my side gig after I got that deal. And then, you know, it kind of morphs into this thing where, that industry is really dying. There's really not a chance to get in there, and you have to decide whether you want to spend all your time butting your head up against a wall. And I'm a little more of a realist than that. So, you know, then you kind of have to pivot to what, like writing a book or something. And so then it becomes less of a side gig and more of a gig, which is fine, because this is like late career for me. I did, you know, everything I wanted to do as a TV critic. So this now I'm just sort of, you know, and I'm, you know, I'm certainly nowhere near retirement age, and I don't want to retire. I don't think any writers actually retire, but, you know, because I'm doing books and all the other stuff. But right now, I just think I just do whatever I want, which is great. Like, it's, I don't know, you talked about being on Hawaii and streaming from the beach. It's like that feeling of like, yeah, this is the life. You know, it comes down to like, what do you want? And I have really, I don't think I took it for granted, the Substack, when I started it. I did think it was more of something that was way off to my side a little bit, you know, when I was focusing on other things. And it's closer to me now. So I'm doing a little bit more of it. But I love it. And I think that, you know, as we discussed, adding movies has been great, because I am seeing a lot more movies. I couldn't do that when I was a full time television critic, because, you know, we were completely drowning. Yeah. I mean, Alan, I'm sure Alan told you the same thing. You know, he's pretty much still doing that. So you just can't, you know, you can't cover that much stuff and see everything. So now that I'm just picking and choosing what I want, and also going back in time, as we said, to, you know, watching a show from 2019 or 2020, watching international series that I've never heard of, that, you know, that were made in, you know, 4 or 5 years ago. That's all fun. And then having this ability to sort of embrace film, something I love and didn't have a chance to when I was doing that, has been great. So I'm just doing kind of like what I want. I think it is always, though, you know, this idea of being self-employed, and which, of course, I mean, you talk to Alan. Alan was the last of the big critics, I think, that, you know, was still, you know, had been in the industry and not sort of let go.
Right.
And, you know, I left of my own volition to do something else. And then that industry, you know, collapsed all around as well.
Right.
And I think today, you know, there's, you know, I really love Pony Wozniak at the New York Times and Sophie Gilbert at the Atlantic. But when Seppenbaugh went left, I mean, that was like a sign that, you know, it's, it, this job is, it, there's not a lot of these jobs out there. So I'm happy to be doing what I'm doing. And, but I'm also happy not to be on that treadmill, which you hinted at.
Right. Right. Cause it was just the, you know, the conveyor belt of shows, until you couldn't do anymore. And between you and Dan Feinberg and freelancers, you had to basically review everything. And that was a peak TV time, basically. So now, I mean, so is the answer to how you avoid burnout and how you regulate is you're self-directed. And so that is how you regulate, is you're only watching the stuff that you want to watch and only as much of it as you want to watch.
Yeah, I think so. I think that I feel like anything that I do, I can for pleasure, because it's all pleasure at this point. Anything that I did for pleasure can be turned into something for the Substack. Sure. Because
welcome to the world of independent content creation.
Exactly.
Turn everything in your life into content.
Turn it into content. Yeah. And, you know, and it's better because I think, you know, I write all the time about time being so valuable for everyone. And so certainly people who are paid subscribers and who stick with me through the years and sort of value that curation that I'm providing, they don't want a terrible show. And like, that's what we had to do as TV critics, right?
Yeah.
And early days in my career, I mean, I was kind of known for that. I could put a beat down on.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I could put a beat down on a lot of things.
Yeah. Some classic stuff, but it doesn't. I mean, it's fun, but who does it benefit? Unless it's like, I was talking about this with Steppenwall, I think. The if it's high profile, you write about it because everybody's talking about it and you're like, no, it's not any good. But like, if it's just a show that's floating in this morass of streaming that we've got and you watch it and it's bad, like, who does it benefit to say, oh, I didn't like that? Like, who cares?
Yeah, but exactly.
But what you do, and we've been talking about this for years, I've talked about it with Alan Seppenwall, is you got to start curating, right? You got to be like finding good stuff and sharing it with other people. And that's, I know you tried to do more of that than THR really wanted you to do, but like that seems to be the real way forward for this is I'm not following you for the treadmill of reviews, but I am following you because you have interesting taste in this stuff and you make finds and say, and wave your hands and are like, hey, over here, Black Summer, right?
Yeah.
And right. That is you providing a value in curation.
Yeah, I think, and that's, you know, as you know all too well, I was, you know, years and years ago, I was there for 9 years, but when I was at the Hollywood Reporter, I wrote really long columns basically saying, hey, this system doesn't work anymore.
Yeah.
The review system doesn't work anymore. And of course, in some ways, you're sort of like stabbing yourself when you say that, but I was trying to get it. So like, let's not be so oriented on being first to review something two weeks prior to it airing. No one's watching like that anymore.
Right.
And as we found out, as you know, as the industry has, especially for critics, but as the industry has kind of crumbled, part of the rationalization of these job losses is that no one's clicking on reviews. Because they'll just come back to it, and or it's too early. They can't think about something that's coming out, 2 weeks or 3 weeks in advance. So they'd much rather talk about something after they've seen it and then engage with you, which is really produced and helped by curation, which is what I do. So, I just knew it was broke back then. You could kind of tell it was, and I was frustrated. And now I think that the people, like I said, with time being so valuable, people are saying, well, now if I'm following Tim and I'm actually paying him to curate stuff, they're all going to be good. The only time I actually, and I don't take any joy in like hammering stuff. So like, that's such a, as you said, that's a waste of time for everybody. But I, the only time I really, you know, get frustrated is when something that we maybe used to call prestige television, and it's something that's on people's mind and they're going to watch, when that goes sideways, yeah, that's really frustrating to me. And I think from my perspective, you know, I just had that with Down Cemetery Road,
right.
You know, from Apple, which was all the Mick Herron books prior to Slough House and all the Slow Horses material. And it's just, and I run into this, you know, a lot. And now I just kind of bail, like, on, you know, I mean, you've probably seen it, but, and I think people appreciate that because my readers will continue on some shows. Like I got out of the Lowdown. It wasn't for me, you know, there's just Black, you know, Black Rabbit, I thought was going to be good. I just became maddening to me. And I don't want to hate watch anything because I don't believe in that. So I get out of it. But like sometimes if you're into a series that is quote unquote prestige and there's like 8 episodes and it falls apart in the 5th or 6th episode, well, you're kind of, now you're committed and you kind of have to be mad about it.
With Down Cemetery Road, you kind of wrote a little, as a reader, you kind of wrote a little diary of your journey through it, right? Where it was like, this is interesting. And then you're like, I'm starting to see some problems. And then you're like, well, I got to the end and it kind of falls apart. And, you know, and that was interesting. It's a different kind of thing then, because you're on the journey, right? And so you can say, watch as this thing fell apart and it happens. But
yeah. And I think that one of the perspectives that I can bring to it, which maybe now kind of I'm a little quicker to frustration, is that, you know, I was, you know, technically I am still in that side of the industry. I could try to write a television series, but, you know, the odds of anything getting made for anybody right now is really impossible. People who have, you know, had successful shows and have run showrunner shows, they're not getting work. A lot of people aren't even living in Hollywood. They're moving away. And I just have so many people down there and so many connections, and it's just such a bleak story. So when you get a chance to make something and then you screw it up, that's really frustrating to me. You know, it's, you know, people who read me regularly know that I'm a little frustrated by the fact that, you know, it's an industry that's run on IP. So you're basically as a TV writer, you're writing somebody else's story. You're not writing your own original story. I get frustrated when someone, has enough, clout and has been in the industry enough to make their own stuff, and they decide to just continue choosing IP product. I mean, maybe that's what the streamers are demanding. But, you know, some people have the power to say, yeah, okay, I'll do this IP series. We'll see where how it goes. If it does great, I'll keep writing it. But I want to do my other project on the side. Not many people are doing that now. So when something comes out, I just get frustrated if you're given this, it's such a, you know, really limited amount of people can, I mean, it's infinitesimal who will get a chance to actually make something. So when you mess it up, I think I get a little bit more mad.
You think Noah Hawley channels all of his creativity into his novels and then is happy to write IP television projects? Because that's the one that I think of, is he's so talented. He did Fargo and he did Legion and he's doing Alien Earth, which I think is a really interesting show, but like he's just decided I'm gonna pick up various intellectual properties and respin them as TV shows. He does a good job at it, but it is someone else's story to a certain extent.
Yeah, I mean, I love Noah Hawley, and but I think Alien Earth was really the breaking point for me. I mean, he's precisely the person who has enough power, especially at FX, to, you know.
Well, he just signed a new Disney deal, right? Which includes another season of Alien Earth, but maybe something that's not based on an existing property, too?
You would think so, because he's doing his own work. So maybe you're right. Maybe he's channeling it into his books.
I don't know.
The irony would be somebody making one of his books into a TV series.
Oh, man. Can you imagine?
Mm-hmm.
Something I talked about with Steppenwall that he expressed admiration of you for is he... What he doesn't do is explore international TV and movies. And I have enjoyed, you always did this. I mean, you recommended Detectorists and like Happy Valley and things like that are off the beaten track, especially at the Hollywood Reporter, where it's like, you know, like, hey, here's a thing out of left field from the UK.
Right.
Instead of just the latest thing off the assembly line in the US. And he admired that because he's like, there's so much stuff that I look at and I need to be told about international. And you seem to be somebody who really enjoys exploring international content, which, and you always have, but I've noticed that in Bastard Machine too, is that like you are happy to look beyond America and even look beyond English language to find stuff that is worth watching.
Yeah, it's absolutely. It's part of that was just the interest in that, and also leaning into countries that were really developing their storytelling capacity and their television production at a pace, you know, where maybe in the past you could look at it and go like if you look at, you know, if you look at South Africa right now, they don't make very good shows. They're not there yet, you know, but Spain and Korea, they're making great stuff. And so we're plenty of like Finland and Sweden and Norway, all the Scandinavian countries are making great work. Obviously the French and the English, we already know that, Germany. So it's out there and it's in surprising places. So I think my curiosity led me there. And then, you know, in combination with watching the American television industry, like not just compressed, I mean, it's kind of imploding. It really is. I don't think anybody has written a story yet about how bleak it is out there. I mean, I have read stories about that, but no one has really, from the inside, from the people who have been in, you know, Sue Nagel, who used to run HBO and ran a film studio. I mean, I talked to her and she's just like, man, it is as bleak as I've ever seen it in 20, 30 years. Like, it's just people are moving out of the industry. People who are very, very successful writers and executive producers can't find work. So, you know, there's like a loss of hope there, I think, in the industry. So that kind of also made me like, okay, well, let's, you know, if once the funnel narrows, Jason, as you know, and less is getting through, it tends to not be the really engaging stuff. It's like IP, it's familiarity that, you know, and easy stuff. That's why I'm applauding, you know, Apple when they do something like Pluribus and Severance and things that are risk taking in some ways. But those are the shows that people are really responding to. Mm-hmm. I don't know what we don't have any real metrics for any of these streamers like we used to with the Nielsen's. But yeah, I started to look internationally just out of curiosity. And, you know, anybody who's been reading me in the last 2 years knows that I have sort of been like super impressed with Korea. I think they're actually storytelling is so far past American storytelling. Mm-hmm. It's kind of shocking.
And we do see international streamers. So Apple and Netflix especially play globally, and mm-hmm. they have invested in content in other regions. And I know that there's been like Netflix has had great success with commissioning Korean shows. So
absolutely,
you know, it isn't mm-hmm. necessarily that you have to go to a niche streamer to find some of this stuff. It ends up showing up on Netflix or Apple.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, Hulu doesn't exist outside of the US. So it's right. like, or, you know,
it's just Disney Plus.
It's just Disney Plus. So, yeah. And we'll see that in here soon enough. But, so Disney Plus, but we see it here as Hulu, also has a really, really wide selection of international fare, particularly stuff from Korea and Japan. Mm. And I think it's harder to find stuff like that on HBO. But if you search, I had one little hack that I wrote about a while ago, especially if you're a movie fan. If you go into, you know, they don't have a very good user interface on HBO, which may become Netflix. But if you go there and you in their search function and you just type in international, that's it. Just type in international. Hmm. You get a really, really insane number of great international movies and some television shows as well. It's stunning. Like I actually found I wrote a very small bit about it mixed in with something else. It's easy to forget or have not seen it, but I wrote about that. And then I had found there was a French film. I've forgot the name right now, but I mean, I saw it in college and it was the funniest thing. I had never like, it was jarring. It was really, it's like a documentary about a serial killer and an inept killer. And it is so brilliant. And, at the time, I had just forgot about it for years. It had sort of changed my life. Like, oh my God, movies can do this. And that was one of the first things that popped up on HBO when I put in international. I started scrolling through and I found it. So, but yeah, there's a lot, MHC, which I know a lot of people don't get. It's still kind of a fringe. People, you know, I think it comes down to people want to either do Acorn or BritBox or, you know, I think MHZ and Viaplay are the ones that, I don't think anybody I know has Viaplay, but, you know, most MHZ has the most international content I found. And, I've done like deep dives on all their content in different countries, and it's so good. Like the stuff you find out sometimes, it's like, you know, Israel has a really thriving TV, and always has been good at television. Spain, of course. But I think the finding out like the Nordic noir stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And how deep that runs, that was been a great discovery. But otherwise, I think Korea and Japan are the ones I'm really impressed with right now.
Yeah, I love to see it. All right. I wanted to mention, so you do sometimes do the, I hate to say the Sepinwallian thing, but a little bit of that, of doing what you call spoiled, but it's basically episode by episode reviews of shows that you choose, and you're, you know, I think it's got to be something that you have things to say about and are enjoying watching or are interested in watching. And, you know, you got on the Pluribus train.
Oh yeah, definitely. It's, you know, I started a thing a while ago called the box set, where we would all watch something together. So while we would do it, you know, I would tell people, I picked this show, let's watch this together. We even did back to back to the both seasons of Patriot eventually. But yeah, we've gone through and done a bunch of these, where like in Severance and Station 11 and things that I think that are going to be popular.
Right. Did Slow Horses and
Slow Horses
and Task, and the Task, and did a thing, sadly, about The Diplomat, which was nice.
Diplomat, very surprising this year. I think I think people really overlooked it this year, except for maybe Sophie Gilbert and soon to be me. But, you know, and Silo and things like that.
Right.
I'll do those. And it's an episode by episode deconstructions, which is, again, yeah, it's a throwback to the days when Sepinwall and everybody who was in I and everybody who was Mo Ryan and all the, you know, everybody who, back when we had a thriving TV critic community, everybody was doing those because you kind of had to. You had to, the internet and blogs were so popular, you really had to, keep doing that, which is like doubled your work, which I'm kind of happy not to have to do right now. But I do love, it's really rare that I do it. And you mentioned this spoiled thing, which was an idea that people wanted to talk about things that they had seen and were finished with, and they wanted to talk in detail and not have to be spoiler hiding and all that kind of stuff. And I didn't really have a great purpose for it, but now I have it when it's, you know, where you can just, that has sort of taken over the box set thing. And because I try to do what's in the zeitgeist and what's popular, and obviously Pluribus doing that right now, and the you know, things that I know will be interesting to write about week to week, which is not, you know, there's not a lot of choices, and that there will be enough people watching them, you know, right, in this crowd that you're actually your subscribers. So it's a little bit of a delicate balance to find the right show, but yeah, I love doing that, breaking stuff down.
Yeah, I'll tell you, that's one of my favorite things. I mean, Sepinwall and I talked about how, I mean, everybody calls them recaps now, but you know, it's not like a Television Without Pity recap where they just tell you what happened, which I never understood. That. They are reviews. You know, you're like, what happened and what we think it means and was it successful and all of that. And for shows that I'm really into, and Pluribus counts, I devour those after. I love the next day reading you writing about it and Sepinwall writing about it and other people writing about it, because I really like having that. It's that just chewing on what we just saw with other people who are carefully watching it and thinking about how this, you know, how it's made and how it's structured and where the story is going and all of that. It just is delightful. It's one of the reasons why I hate binge drops. Because every the atomic television episode becomes just like completely junk food, basically. It's just pass on to the next one. And I really like taking time, and I've really enjoyed it with Pluribus, which of course has the additional benefit of being, thanks to Vince Gilligan and his X-Files training and all of that, combined with his pacing that he learned with Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul, he is very slowly doling out information. He's making you wait. He's making you wonder. And boy, that's fun to do week to week, to speculate and to ponder what we've learned. And Pluribus strikes me as being a show that really hits that sweet spot.
It's one of the few. Severance is another.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think the studio works as well. Bear works.
Yeah. Yeah.
Slow Horses obviously is a really good one. So there's ones that do work. Pluribus is great, just like Severance, because you have these puzzle box shows and that already intrigues people. And so they want to know what's going on. And if you have a series creator and writer who has, you know, built in a number of nuanced issues to explore with their characters, mm-hmm. then there's so much meat in the bone every week. And like you said, if it's Netflix and they drop it all in one day, I can't do that. So that's where that one element of how Spoil worked. You know, it was a concept that I thought, oh, this isn't going to have any legs. And now I found that I can use it for like something on Netflix where I just like, because you never know who's watched how many. No one's right. watching at the same pace because you're not watching it at the same time. So if, you know, I'll just dump a whole season in there. If I think people have been watching something on Netflix and they want to talk about it, I'll do that after, you know, you just have to wait for a little bit. It's so much more fun, though, with like Pluribus and series that come out, you know, weekly. To sit there and wait until they come out, like it's old school in some way, and then write a I've never called it a recap in my entire life. Yeah, I don't think anybody will ever see that. Nope. I have used the word deconstruction since for like 20 love years it. Probably, and so that's what I do. And yeah, I love those. But again, it's like just a little bit of a tangent. If Netflix gets HBO, so they'll have the HBO streaming stuff. I mean, who knows how that's all going to be? You'll have the vault, the shows that are in the vault,
right?
But new shows coming through it, which would have come through HBO, are going to come through Netflix, and then there are two different models. HBO drop them weekly. You know, they maybe give you one or two episodes, and you know, that's how it works.
We'll see. I sort of feel like they're going to make HBO like a premium thing. With its own rules and its own programming, and like you'll have to pay extra to get it, even on Netflix, which would be a first for them, right? They've never walled off content behind
that would be interesting.
A paywall, but like just build, and you could potentially even sell it through Amazon channels and Apple TV and stuff as a standalone HBO. But the idea that Netflix would have HBO, and if you wanted the HBO content in Netflix, you'd need to pay them more. Pay them another, like cable. Remember, cable. Pay like $13 a month more, and you get HBO.
I think I would do that, by the way. So
yeah,
I don't love it, but I would do it.
And I like the idea of Casey Bloys continuing to be able to do a good job generating shows for HBO. Like it would be kind of nice to not lose that and have it just kind of dissolve into the Netflix of it all.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm sure you have talked about this, no doubt, and probably will have a lot of reasons to talk about it in the future, which is also, you know, that's to our point about the industry contracting and the changes that make. So if, you know, if it does turn out that the deal goes through and Netflix absorbs HBO and they don't need Casey Bloys, who I really, really like a lot, and his entire team of drama and comedy development people, that's a lot of jobs lost.
Yeah.
For starters, that is another separate outlet that writers can't go to now. Now they have to go through Netflix to do it. So, I mean, I like your idea because it keeps Casey and those guys employed, right.
It keeps another thing. I feel like Ted Sarandos has said, like they really value HBO, and I think this is this is my theory anyway. And I think they've said that they might do this. Is that, you know, just as Netflix is saying, well, we've never had a movie studio before, but now we're going to do that. We're going to change. I think this is opening the door to Netflix finally doing a channel strategy where they're like, we are TV. And we, you know, if you want, like, they also probably have AMC. Joe Adalian is on that case about that. Nobody really knows whether or not AMC, TCM, whether TCM is going with on the raft with the cable channels or whether Netflix would keep it. But like I could see channels within Netflix is really interesting, right? Because then Netflix becomes like the cable company, and they're like, but you can pay more and get this whole other block of content, but it's premium and you got to pay us even more for that. And you could do that with TCM too, potentially. You could say, we got classic movies too. You just pay an extra $10 a month and you get classic movies on Netflix. And it's like, I could see it. I could see it.
We'll see if they do it. Maybe that is very funny that Joe is on the case. When Joe's on the case of something, he's relentless.
If it's old stuff, Joe is. Yeah. Well, what he realized is that people were reporting different things. And so he had to go to Netflix and say, what is this? And my understanding is it was people at Netflix going, we don't know. And like trying to figure it out. Cause it's like, because a lot of people, I know it's not a big audience compared to all of Netflix or all of HBO even, but like TCM is the place where classic movie lovers, like it is a beloved thing. Right. So the question is like, where does that go? It will be interesting to see, but I feel again, like there's a place for that as a niche, you know, something for that audience, but I guess we'll see. I'm loving Pluribus, by the way. I thought you wrote about the most recent episode as we record this, which is The Gap. Episode 7, mm-hmm. And you said something that I thought was very Tim Goodman, because you said it was arguably its best episode.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that. I agree, actually. But what I have heard, this is fascinating, is I have heard people complain about the pace of the plot and the revelations. And I get it. Like, what happens, I mean, Carol doesn't do anything, really. Mm-hmm. In episode 7, and we get Manosis, who's going through the jungle, mm-hmm. which I don't understand how you would watch that and say it was boring. It's riveting to me.
Right,
but
exactly.
But I thought it was really telling that some people want plot payoff. And one of the things I admire about what Pluribus is doing is there's stuff every week, but like it wants you to live in this world. It wants you to see the world's effect on these characters, and it wants to take its time to do that. I mean, right down to the detail of the fact that every time she calls the voicemail, we have to listen to the entire voicemail every time. That is Vince Gilligan saying, slow it down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I admire it. And I knew you would like it because, you know, visual studies and all of that, like it's beautiful. It's about characters, and it is about sort of like taking your time. And I get why people are frustrated, but I loved it. I absolutely love it.
Yeah, I think the job of criticism, which is, you know, in the mainstream is almost non-existent, except for, you know, some people. There's not really not much left. But, you know, our job, I think, as critics is to, if you're going to wear that hat realistically, you have to talk about why that episode is. So, you know, you can say, well, you just didn't get it, you know, or you can just say, no, it was really great. So you're wrong. But you have to tell people why it's important, why it was good. And that's how people can learn. But I mean, this idea of, you know, people are going to be people. They're going to sometimes they can't change. I think it's better when they learn to love a show on the merits that's being presented by the creator. Like mm-hmm. if you really love Sopranos, you know, that was one of the I think that was the show that was at least that we could probably look back to and say, OK, everybody in the country is aware of this. Everybody's talking about it on some level. And the divide between people who didn't like any of the therapy stuff and then only wanted the violence, you know, you had to talk to them saying, yeah, okay, it's both.
Yeah, and they inform each other.
Yeah. They inform each other. And, you know, and I would say, I would make the argument that it's really, that's what David Jase is really leaning into is the interior life of Tony and not the, so much the gangster stuff. And, you know, people didn't really want to hear that, but I think an evolution of a viewer is when you help them say, no, this is really why it's great. The same thing you would do with a film, I think, which is very much, you know, it's much, there's more, I think, to talk about in a film because there's less answers mm-hmm. than these concrete TV shows. But to your point, I think that, you know, I loved it too, that episode, but I do think I just want to finish this thought because it's like, it's so true about Pluribus and I struggled with it too. So I'm not saying like, you know, I even just two episodes ago, I was like, hey, you know, we're only got three episodes left. So, you know, but then they went and delivered The Gap and I was like, okay, like I get it now. I mean, I've complained a little bit, not too much, but like, I get it now. I said, we're going on our own pace now. I don't care. Because, you know, I look at the end, I always look at my watch, not the end of the episode, but like metaphorically looking at your watch thing, they don't have enough episodes to wrap this up.
Right. So how are you pacing this?
Yeah. So, you know, if people don't know that now, they're going to be really upset predictably at the finale. Is like, oh, this is definitely going to be on a cliffhanger. There's no question about that.
It was a 2-season order. Of course it is.
It's a 2-season order and it'll keep going on. That's just how a lot of streamers do it, especially when you have as much weight as Vince, that you're going to give him as many episodes or seasons as he probably wants. But, he's going to play this out at his pace. And if you like his work and if you love the show, which people are tuning into, you have to say, okay, well, I may want something different, but the person who created the show and has got me here, I should trust him a little bit more.
He wants you to see this, right? You've talked about it a little bit, but like one of the things I love about Pluribus is that like any good science fiction, we'll call it that.
Yeah.
It is about metaphor, right? That's the point is not just like a logical thought exercise of what would happen if the premise of Pluribus, but it's, like, it's never clearer than in episode 7 that Pluribus is about grief. It's about isolation. It's about loneliness. Among other things, it's about, how we relate as individuals to society. There's a lot of interesting things to chew on in Pluribus. And the stuff where Carol doesn't do anything, quote unquote, in that episode it's just such a great, like, watching her go through stages of grief. And she's grieving for her partner, but she's also grieving for the world. And she decides she's going to treat herself. And then, by the end of that episode, she's run out of things to have fun with and there's still nobody around. And it's tragic. And like, it's so good. So I understand people want answers and people want the mystery to evolve. And I totally do too. But like, I'm also willing to go on the ride because I know Vince Gilligan has reasons to do what he's doing. And I am happy to put myself in his hands and let him take me there.
Absolutely. I mean, subtext is so important to sort of learn that, how that works. I mean, same thing with Severance, right? You know, you're always going to, I think we're all scarred in some way, Jason, by Lost.
Yeah. I was going to bring up Lost earlier, especially when Manusus is driving around the cliff sides, which I guess are in Spain, but it is supposedly in South America. And I was like, oh, I'm getting a little Lost vibe here. and Lost was like that, right? It was paying off. So Lost, I didn't think Lost ended as badly as most people did. But what I would say is, I think I never really understood people who were like, I'm in Lost for the mysteries, because I thought the best thing about Lost was it's basically what you said earlier, which is those flashbacks in Lost were all about, like with The Sopranos, informing the decisions in the present and understanding the damage of the people in the past that leads to who they are in the present. And like the whole point of it was toggling between their life before and their life now and how past events impact on your present behavior and all of that. And then there are people who are like, but what's in the hatch? I'm like, okay, all right. I mean, I want to know what's in the hatch too, but I don't mind taking an episode to learn what Sawyer's deal is, right? Like, I don't mind that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, but and,
yeah.
But Lost, I think everybody's scarred from Lost. I think it's true.
Well, I mean, part of it was they would propose 5 questions and then they would answer 2.
Yeah.
But when they're answering the 2, they would ask 5 more.
Yeah. And they didn't know the answers to half of them. I think the fundamental problem with that show is that they didn't know. I think Vince Gilligan knows exactly where he's going. Not that he isn't open to change and has like ideas, but like, I don't think he's just kind of making it up as he goes along. I think I trust him that he knows where he's going. Certainly in the first 2 seasons. I'm certain that was part of the deal.
To be fair though, I did note, saying that same thing. I think I was making the point that, hey, it's Vince Gilligan. Dude, this guy's made 2 of the 10 greatest television shows ever. Like, I think he's earned our trust. I did throw in there like, let me tell you a story back when I asked him about Breaking Bad and he told me he didn't know where it was going. Yeah.
Well, I think he may, here's what I think. I think Vince Gilligan knows what the wrinkles are in this science fictional premise in Pluribus. I think he knows the deal.
Yeah,
where the story goes and how it gets there. I think it's good to be open to like, maybe things are different than we thought. And maybe characters, performances lead you in different places and all of that. But I don't think he's like, geez, I guess I got to figure out why this happened. Like,
right.
I don't think he doesn't know that.
I think that's a little bit of a good jumping off point too. It's like really great television. The stuff that I'm touting, that you're watching, probably your listeners are watching, is shows that can surprise you and that have a really, you're put in the hands of a really great storyteller and you let them do their work. Mm. And, you know, there's so much stuff we watch these days that doesn't surprise at all. And, you know, I went back and looked at some of the stuff that I loved the most of the season, and there's like crazy stuff in there, like Department Q, which I kind of loved. And it's just all over the place. And, you know, there's, you just kind of have to be surprised by things. Mm. And to close some circles here, I have found that internationally, the series creators and writers are not at all. First of all, they're not informed so much about the American storytelling experience, or they've figured it out and they don't either use it or adhere to every single detail of it, which makes it great. Mm-hmm. So the storytelling, I think, rhythms are completely different. And the ability to take more risks is there. Right. So I think you find some more challenging stuff internationally as well.
Okay. I want now that it's the end of the year, we got to talk about what are you doing for best of the year, and share with us some of your best of the year shows. I would love to know.
Last December was the first time that I've done it on this Substack, because I just, you know, just wasn't really, I joked back then that, like, you know, I have done so many of these lists and they've just been, they're so, you know, OCD and parsed out and different rules and things that you can just really get taken away with it. But I did the first one last year on the Substack saying, look, this is just the best of what I watched. And if it came, as we said earlier in this podcast, if it came out and I watch it this year, then it's the this year show.
Yeah.
But I think the surprise thing when I went back, Jason, was just seeing how surprised I was at how much great stuff was there. And I haven't put them all quite in their order. Sure. But I'll give you a sense of some of the ones that were easy for me to pick up top of the list.
Yeah.
And I've checked in with, you know, I've looked at some of the critics I really respect and some of their lists. And I'm a little surprised that certain things are missing. Which is great, because I mean, everybody has different opinions. I do think there's some recency bias that we all play into. So I was surprised when I went back to the beginning of the year and found things that I really liked. But the ones that were easy to talk about were Severance, Studio, mm-hmm. International series called Families Like Ours, which was brilliant. Now, obviously, you'll have Pluribus on there, but they have, they've got a couple more episodes to go. And mm-hmm. my thing will probably appear before those episodes are over. But I've seen enough to know that I think it's pretty going to be pretty great. I think The Diplomat was, you know, its third season was maybe its best season. And
yeah, I mean, I like the first season, too. The second season, it seemed like they were not sure what show they were making. And maybe because of the strike it was short and it. I don't get it, but the third season they sort of recast what they wanted the show to be. I think also it's very much them just embracing the fact that it is kind of the West Wing.
It's very much the West Wing, and it also is just you have such strong female characters that very few shows have those now. Yeah. Certainly American shows, but that is that was really good. I think another series, The Bear, falls into the same issue with Diplomat. The Bear had a previous season was terrible, or not very good. And then this was a real comeback year for it. And I think The Bear should be higher, probably on a lot of people's lists, because they pulled off some magic this current season. So just like The Diplomat came back with one of its strongest ones. In no order, I liked Asura, the Japanese series. I liked Ken Burns' American Revolution, Slow Horses. Everybody remember talked about Adolescence, Department mm-hmm. Q. You know, those were kind of the main ones. And then when the stuff that was much more geared towards international, even just on BritBox, the real fun bits of Ludwig
is one of my top. shows.
Yeah, it's just great. You know, it's so good. It's easy to, you know, where do you put Ludwig when you have like Severance and Pluribus,
yeah,
right? You
know? But, I mean, so for me, Ludwig, Pluribus, The Pit,
mm-hmm.
Adolescence. I mean, these are my top. They are at the right. top. But I put Ludwig up there. Like, that is exactly my jam, that show. David Mitchell
Absolutely.
Is perfect. It's funny. It's got good mysteries. It's got an interesting setting. It's that was one of my fun. I mean, part of it is the discovery of a thing that you didn't know existed that is this obscure little thing. And then you find it and you're like, oh, this is a gem. Why is nobody talking about this? And it turned out
it
just sort of slid onto BritBox and people didn't know. And Department Q, I thought it was great. Like,
it was great.
Really
yeah.
great.
Mm-hmm. It's so hard to be surprised. And Department Q, I was very surprised with. I watched a Korean series called Nine Puzzles, and it wasn't my favorite of all the Korean shows. On my list, I probably have like, I don't know, 8 or 9 of those. But I will say that I stuck with it. I had given up on it a couple of times. I stuck with it because it's a very unique, very Korean kind of way of certain things. It's very cultural that I didn't understand. But as far as a mystery, very much like Department Q, the twists and turns on that thing were super impressive, I have to say. Like, mm-hmm. at the end, you're just like, okay, did not think that's where they were going.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, just a couple of random mm-hmm. other ones. I think that Deli Boys was really great and unheralded when it was on. Very funny. The Korean shows I liked were, and they range from, I always say the thing that they do best is revenge stories. Nobody does revenge stories better than the Koreans. And they also do tons and tons of romance. There's millions of romantic series, and that's not always my jam. And when you mix them, some of them work out. Like, there's a thing called The Trunk, which was that has romance in it, but it has action and mystery, and that worked out really well. But like the stuff that becomes kind of more what I consider their wheelhouse, which is this sort of action, revenge, and really great plotting and character development. They had a series called Karma, which I liked, and Trigger, and it's another one called My Name, which was not in 2025, but also really good. And one of the ones that I liked the best was a series called Extracurricular, which is, I joke with my partner KB that so many of these series, Korean series, are set in schools. They have a bullying problem, just like the Brits do. But I laugh because you're in this realm of high school kids, and you would think as an adult that we're all adults, like, I can't come past that now. But that's the American version. These Korean shows, if they're placed in a high school, which a lot of them are, and it's usually the same high school, they're very adults. And so this mm-hmm. one, Extracurricular, they can be hyper violent, but they're smart. So they're not like they're not like American teens. You really have to become dispossessed of that idea. And Extracurricular is a really unique kind of like, how are they even showing this on TV kind of story? And I was just impressed with it all the way through.
Nice.
Yeah.
Pretty good
so,
year.
Yeah. I have more, but there's just, I have a lot of them. So there's no need to hit all of those, but
there's no editor telling you can only do 10.
Yeah. Luckily I got away with that a lot, both at the Chronicle and at the, mm-hmm. THR, but it was a little more of a fight at the end at THR where I was like, okay, there's going to be 3 different lists now. Yeah. So they were just, because I'm like, I'm definitely going to rank everything. And there's, the big fight that everybody had when I first got there was like, well, just give us your top 10. I'm like, no, I'm going to do all like 32 or I'm not doing any. You're not recognizing television at all in its scope and its capacity for entertainment and quality if you just do 10 and limit yourself to that. So, but yeah, I don't have to do that anymore at Substack. So
did you not like The Pit or did you not watch it?
No, I mean, that's a good thing to put in. I'm going to put that in my review or whatever list I make. So like, I don't have Andor on there, which, you know, my partner KB watched and she thinks is one of the best series of 2025 because I didn't watch Andor.
Right.
So that's just it. And The Pitt, I didn't watch it because it's a hospital drama and I tend not to watch those for personal reasons. You know, and I've said, I just don't like it. It's not my thing.
I get it.
Yeah. And so like, I just don't want to see people in the hospital. Yeah. So
no, it's fair. I'll tell you, it's good.
Yeah.
But you already knew that.
I heard it's really good.
It is very good, but it's also not your cup of tea.
It's not my cup of tea. And like, you know, you actually have pointed this out a couple of times. Like, I think, you know, clearly, I think you actually, the funniest thing you I think ever said to me was when we were looking at Only Murders in the Building. And you're like, of course, this is not your thing.
Yeah.
Because like, you know, this is just so not your show. You shouldn't even like, don't waste your time talking about it.
It's just like fuzzy sweaters and kind of cute. And the tone is, it's just not for you.
It's not for me. Whereas Ludwig, I think, struck that great balance where it was for me, even though it was like a old throwback, like the sort of British solving a mystery.
It's the British mystery, but then you get David Mitchell in the center of it and it, playing a character who's very strange in a situation that is ridiculous. And so you get a lot of good comedy bits plus a good mystery. It's like that was the magic for me of that, was that it was more right. It's like British mystery plus.
I think, you know, when you bring up The Pit, the thing that strikes me is when I make my list, I'll obviously tell, because people will ask why Andor and The Pit for two really strong examples aren't on there. And I think I have a good reason for why they're not. Yeah. But then I will put on the ones that I just, you know. People, because you know, this is what always happens. You make a list, you forgot. People say you forgot. No, I didn't actually forget that.
Yeah,
I didn't like that.
I get that. Like, I can't believe you didn't mention. It's like, well, there's a reason. Do you like that? Because you didn't want me to mention it.
Yeah.
I'm not going to say nice things about it.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, this has been a lot of fun. I'm glad we could reconnect. We should do this more often.
Yeah, we should do this. Yeah, instead of just holidays, we can do this more often.
You don't have to be Santa Claus, although I do enjoy you coming down the chimney.
You know,
on downstream.
I've slimmed down a little bit. I can get down there a little bit better now.
Yeah, good. It's good. And you found your microphone, which is the most important thing.
I did. You know, I did laugh as we were prepping for this. I was like, oh man, I used to be like have everything. Well, you might disagree with that, but I thought I was pretty organized in the past, and I had my stuff. This time, I'm pulling out a box with all these cords, and I'm like, oh damn, which one goes with which, and how do I set this thing up? So. Times change.
Yeah. Well, and you're living in two different places too. And so that's a whole extra complication of like, you know, is it here? Is it there?
Where is it in Portland?
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, it's been so great talking to you. People should go again to timgoodman.substack.com, check it out for free, and then subscribe and read all the many things there at The Bastard Machine. I have one. I got a letter from a listener.
Oh my God.
By the way, a bunch of people give me the area code and still say love to your mothers. So I love that.
Yes.
This was follow up from our last episode where John H. wrote in and said that they made a big deal about how The Pit was going to air on TNT uncut, but that they took all the F-bombs out. It's not uncut. And Joe didn't believe him. And we said, we assigned John H. to go check it up. And he did. And this is what John H. said. The Pit TNT follow-up. I did go back and check the first episode on HBO Max, and the first episode does not have that many F-bombs. But in the second episode, there is a young boy who ends up in the ER because he ate pot gummies. Father was irresponsible. The mom is extremely upset, and there is a scene where she says, at a minimum, 6 F-bombs. I made sure to have the closed captions on. The TNT broadcast version at 9 p.m., 10 p.m. for episode 2, edited out the F-bombs. So there it is. There apparently is something that TNT wants to cut
from The Pit. See?
And that's what it is. So John H., Gold Star, thank you for investigating. Now we know. We've called TNT on its lies.
I love that. And, I love that.
And that's it. If you haven't yet, please consider subscribing to Downstream Plus. This is a full-sized episode for everyone, but the only way to hear complete versions of probably our next episode, as well as having them be ad-free all the time, is to subscribe. You can do that at downstream.plus. And, of course, if you want to write in, visit downstreamfeedback.com. We love to hear from you. Love to your mothers. And that brings us to the end. Once again, you can find me at sixcolors.com, other podcasts here at Relay, and over at theincomparable.com. And we will see you next year. Goodbye.
Yes. Bye.